Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to say we have as our first guest a man who has served with distinction in several different capacities in that war, notably in the uniform of the United States Marine Corps. He was involved in planning and the execution of operations Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom. He's a man who has been, I think, involved with Central Command and the United States Marine Corps' special operators in ways that have really honed the skills that he's now bringing to bear with considerable effect, I'm very pleased to say, at an institution with whom we get to work a lot, the Heritage Foundation, where he is a senior research fellow with responsibility for defense programs at the Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy. He is, of course, Dakota Wood. Dakota, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Hey, thanks. Very kind and pleasure to be with you.
Well, the pleasure is mine, not least because you have been one of the driving forces behind a product that I think is of incalculable importance. Just released, I think, the new version of it. You call it the Index of U.S. Military Strength. You've got a background in assessing these sorts of things, both our capabilities and those of adversaries. Give us a flavor of what you have found in this new index is the state of the U.S. military.
Well, we believe that the U.S. military, just cutting to the chase, is marginally able to meet the national security demands placed upon it in defending U.S. interests both here at home and abroad. And this is a consequence of the parlous state of funding defense for the past several years from the Budget Control Act, and the trend lines are all negative. So we've assessed the Army is really getting into a weak status, the Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps as being in that marginal zone as well, and even our U.S. nuclear strategic capabilities in that middle grade. We gave it a C or a marginal status too.
Well, let's go through each of those in turn, because I think this is an effort to provide a kind of empirical evaluation with as much objectivity as you can. And as I say, I think it's a great service because there's a lot of loose talk about all of these things, but you've tried to really quantify where we are and where we're likely to wind up if corrective action is not taken. Start with the Army. It's, of course, greatly reduced in size, but what else is going on that makes it, weak at the moment?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest driver for the weak status was really a capacity issue. And to understand how we assessed each one of the services, there was the same technique or methodology that you alluded to. By comparing our tanks versus Russian tanks, for instance, you know, that's a bean counting exercise. And what's lost in that kind of an assessment is operational concepts, leadership, organizational structures, all the things that really make a military force effective. So we said, you know, what we can do for the American public is to tell them the state of affairs with their military relative to the nature of threats in the world and whether it's easy or difficult to operate in the world. So in capacity and looking at the Army, we said historically the Army has used about 20 or 21 brigades in Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, Iraqi Freedom, you know, any large thing, it's about the same size force. And if you wanted to be able to handle a war and deter somebody else in other parts of the world or do things, then you kind of need twice that size. So we assess that the Army needs about 50 brigades based on historical data and a number of major studies, and they've had just a few years ago 45 brigades, and they're now down to 32. So when you see this decline in capacity going from 560,000 soldiers now below 500 to 490, and they're on their way to 450,000, it really becomes a numbers matter. Can you do things to keep forces in the field, handle attrition in combat, provide a sufficiently large rotational base to get fresh units in and out of theaters, and you find yourself wearing out the force? So this numbers issue really plagues the Army, and when you start using a smaller number of things up much more rapidly, it causes readiness problems and ultimately results in a larger modernization or replacement bill. So the Army is really in a dire state.
Dakota Woods is our guest. He is one of, at least, the authors of this new product of the Heritage Foundation, the Index of U.S. Military Strength. And Dakota, as you were speaking, I was thinking about one aspect that has historically driven American force structure decisions and capabilities requirement setting, and that is that we need to be able to meet challenges in, as you put it, more than one theater at a time. I gather that's really over the side at the moment, and what you have described makes it sound as though we may not be able to do all that well in just a single war at the moment.
Yeah, it's. I think that if we had a rally to fight a single opponent in one theater, qualitatively, we could take them. I mean, I think I really believe we could win a major war, but that would take almost the totality of what America has. So if you want to fight wars away from the homeland, that means that the United States has to project power and sustain efforts anywhere from 3,000 to 8,000 miles away. Meanwhile, you're going up against your opponent that's operating on his home turf. So he has all of his assets right there. You have to project power thousands of miles from home, and it just takes a lot to be able to do that.
Especially if at the same time, people who may or may not be associated with your adversary in that one theater see this as a window of opportunity to work against your interests at the same moment. And Dakota, very quickly, let's talk about the Navy and Air Force. You've described the need for power projection, and I couldn't agree with you more about wanting to fight the war someplace else. How are those elements, which have been critical historically to the fighting of wars elsewhere, faring at the moment as well?
Yeah, again, it's a capacity and a readiness issue. Every major study for the last 30 years has said that the Navy needs somewhere between 340, 350 ships. Their own studies in the Navy said at a minimum, at an absolute minimum, just to meet today's defense strategic guidance requirements, they need 308. They currently have 272. So 272 against a historical requirement of 340.
And I understand they're going down to something like 235 or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah, well, it's possible. The GAO and Congressional Research Service have assessed that the Navy needs about $20 billion a year for new shipbuilding construction to replace ships that wear out and you have to then decommission. The Navy currently has about $15 billion. So you're already operating at a $5 billion deficit. And I just don't see how you get from 272 up to 308. I think you actually continue on a downward slope. So it's a capacity issue, deferred maintenance, which means broken things stay broken. That leads to more broken stuff, and so your maintenance bill goes up. On the Air Force, it's lack of money to maintain competency because you don't have money for gas, for flight hours, therefore pilots don't stay as ready as they need to be. Chief of Staff of the Air Force has said about one-third of the squadrons are actually combat ready, which tells you that there's a dramatic readiness problem in the Air Force. And in about 80% of the Air Force's attack fighter fleet is about 90% through its lifespan. So you build a plane for a certain number of flight hours. We've used them at much higher rates of usage in Iraq, Afghanistan, now Syria, and elsewhere. And they're not able to replace those, again, because of a lack of funding.
As I understand it, we're looking at an Air Force that in sheer numbers of aircraft, to say nothing of, you know, how aging those aircraft are, is as small as it's been since the founding of the United States Air Force. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, you look at the Army Air Corps as it came out of World War II and then it was re-flagged as the U.S. Air Force. and you look at the number of aircraft, and it's a continual downward slope. Now, one argument is an aircraft of the 70s, 80s, 90s, or today was so much better than what we had in the 50s. So one airplane can do much more in a given battle space. And that argument holds for a while, but at some point, you break it. In that, if you're being in several theaters, you're having to handle attrition, a few number of aircraft just cannot dominate airspace over a large area or in multiple areas.
Especially as the quality of our adversaries' air corps improves dramatically, which is happening, as you know. We have to pause for just a moment. We're going to be continuing our conversation with Dakota Wood of the Heritage Foundation about the state of the United States military and what it might mean for you right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.